Google is the largest search engine in the world, the largest video platform, the largest browser, and the most used email service and mobile operating system. This has led the chief executive of one of Europe's largest media publishers to say that his company is afraid of the power that Google has accumulated, and he worries that it is becoming a super state, immune from regulation. That is one of the top stories on the Savvy Ars Technica website. Its Baltimore-based IT editor, Sean Gallagher, joins us this hour to talk about Google, but also about another digital age giant, Amazon. In addition to all of its other pursuits, Amazon is reportedly developing its own smartphone. Sean Gallagher joins us for Midday Tech after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks for joining us for our second hour. 1,000 tiny paper cuts. That's how a woman described the constant sexism she experiences working in the technology sector in a recent New York Times story entitled Technology's Man Problem. According to that story, many people within the field say it's dominated by an alpha male culture that can make women feel unwelcome, demeaned, or even endangered. We'll talk about that piece a little later on in this hour of the show. Today, our hour devoted to technology and technology news and trends, and there's a lot to cover. Toward the end of the hour, we'll look at Facebook's so-called identity crisis following its recent purchase of the virtual reality company Oculus. We'll also examine Amazon's business strategy following recent reports that it's getting ready to roll out a smartphone, release expected later this year, a 3D hologram smartphone from Amazon, possibly. Joining me in Studio A for this hour, Sean Gallagher, media technology contributor for our show now. Sean is the IT editor for the Condé Nast technology site Ars Technica. He's based here in Baltimore. Sean, it's nice to get you back on the show.
Glad to be here.
We got a bunch of things to cover this hour, including Heartbleed bug and NSA. There's a story that Ars Technica has, though, just from the last day or so that I thought I'd ask you off the top of.
Okay.
Pretty catchy headline here. Let me read it. Major media publisher admits it is afraid of Google, quoting a media publisher in Germany. The chief executive of the company, concerned that Google has just gotten too big and too omnipresent. It's the largest, of course, the largest search engine in the world, the largest video platform, the largest browser, the most used email service, and all of that. And this particular publisher pointing out that Google just may have so much power, maybe everywhere in use, especially its search engine, that it's a monopoly, that it could actually, I think in his term, become a super state beyond regulation. What did you think of this concern expressed by this executive?
Their hyperbolic versions of concerns have been around about Google for quite some time. Because
right.
Google is, among all those other things, it's the biggest advertising platform in the world. And Google derives its revenue from tagging advertising on all those searches that you do, and getting advertising derived from your emails, and getting advertising derived from just about everything else you do that involves a Google service, and collecting information from you when you use a Google application, your smartphone.
So in terms of a large media publisher in Europe, it's a competitor.
It is a competitor, and also it's the only way that many people get to media sites. If you search for something, the way you're delivered to a media site is through a Google search mm-hmm. most of the time,
mm-hmm.
Unless you're daily going to check pages. If you get a roll of pages you check by yourself, if you're looking for a specific topic, you generally use a Google search or some other search engine to find what you're looking for. And Google has the power to stack things in those search results in a way that benefits Google. So there's the concern that Google could control what you get to read based on what you're looking for.
In terms of regulation, when I saw that word associated with Google, with the internet, I don't know what we have or what there could be. When it comes to antitrust concerns, we have in the United States a Justice Department that looks into those matters. Is that ever raised with regard to these large companies?
There have been concerns about antitrust with technology in the past. Microsoft is the biggest case that
sure.
in terms of them splitting off the browser from the operating system
right.
back in the 90s, in the early 2000s. The bigger concern is the fragmentation of the internet, because, and that's a side effect of what happened with the NSA. A lot of countries are looking at ways to regulate the internet within their own country to prevent organizations and companies from outside of their countries from controlling the internet within their country. So, for example, Brazil almost passed a law that required data centers to be in Brazil, which would have been very expensive because, as you know, Brazil is a very warm country and cooling computers can become very expensive
yes.
in a very warm country, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is such a great concern about privacy that there are regulations in place to prevent companies from moving data out of countries to other countries. So, for example, in Europe, the privacy laws in Europe require that no personal information can leave Europe, leave those countries and be moved to the United States because the United States doesn't have the same privacy protection. And through regulations like that, governments are already having an impact on Google and other companies. There have been some estimates of $1 billion worth of losses to the technology industry in the United States as a whole
because of
the NSA leaks and because mm-hmm. of the things that have happened since then in cracking down and pulling back from using American services.
Speaking of the NSA, we're going to move on to that story about Heartbleed, the Heartbleed bug, Sean, because this involves, of course, hackers, the internet, and internet viruses. A lot was made earlier this month about this Heartbleed bug, so I think it's great that we have you here today to sort of unscramble this for us. First of all, what is the Heartbleed bug? What did it do allegedly?
Well, the Heartbleed bug, say that five times fast, right? The Heartbleed bug was a miscoding, a typo essentially in the code for a small piece of the software that's called OpenSSL that does encryption for websites and for a number of other pieces of software. It encrypts communications across the internet. The typo was in a piece of the code that is called the Heartbeat extension of that code. And what Heartbeat is it's something where if you're doing a big file transfer between one point and another and you're afraid that the connection to the other end isn't listening anymore, you send a request for a heartbeat to the server to say, hey, are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
If you are, repeat this back to me.
Okay.
And that's what and so when the server gets that message, it takes the same message and it spits it back. It does that by copying it into memory and then from its memory, sending it back out again.
Okay.
The Heartbleed bug allowed someone to send a request that said nothing, and the server would send back what was in its memory.
Uh-oh.
Which could have been a password.
Encryption,
it's all unencrypted on that end.
Unencrypted.
Because it's all been unencrypted by the encryption
software.
This
is why there was so much concern about personal passwords.
Right. So in effect, what it allowed people to do, what it allows people to do, because there are still servers out there that are vulnerable, is they can send these requests constantly to a server or to other devices that use the software for encryption and get back chunks of what's in its memory. And that can include usernames, passwords, the encryption keys that are used by the software to do the encryption in the first place, all unencrypted, sent back to the attacker.
Who detected the bug and how much damage had it done?
There were a couple of programmers from a company called Cryptonomicon and a developer at Google discovered the bug working together by reviewing the code. There's no knowledge of how much damage has been done because it's been there for 2 years. And there were no known public attacks out there. However, in some of the research that I did and conversations I had with other people who are familiar with the bug, there are traces of what could have possibly been Heartbleed attacks in the server logs from various servers that date back before last November. So it may have already been out in the wild for some time and used against targeted servers, which means that, you know, in some cases, some people's passwords and usernames and even the cryptography keys of different servers may have been exposed months, maybe even a year ago, and used by, well, the suggestion is by intelligence agencies hackers.
Let me get to that. This brings up the NSA, because the allegation was the NSA knew about this major flaw in internet security.
And they denied that.
And deny it. But the accusation was that the NSA took advantage of this.
Right. There was a Bloomberg story Bloomberg News story where they had two unnamed sources say that the NSA knew about it from almost the start, so for almost 2 years, and had used it to get intelligence information from targets.
And NSA has denied it vehemently.
And there's also, and there was a denial issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence as well.
Interesting story from the New York Times reporting on President Obama's reaction to this, right? President Obama saying that has decided that the NSA, when the NSA discovers something like this, like the Heartbleed bug, it should, in most circumstances, key words there, reveal them to assure that they will be fixed rather than keep mum so that the flaws can be used in espionage or cyber attacks. Mr. Obama carved a broad exception for, quote, a clear national security or law enforcement need, a loophole that is likely to allow the NSA to continue to exploit security flaws, both to crack encryption on the internet and to design cyber weapons. Now, that doesn't assume that it,
that doesn't mean that they did. But that's also been the NSA's policy for some time.
Okay.
The NSA, the new director of the NSA, when he was going through his Senate confirmation hearings, said that the NSA's policy has been and continues to be to default towards exposing bugs and telling the vendors who they affect about them.
In some cases, major corporations,
right? Right. And so that's their default. However, they certainly do also hide some of those, keep them in their pockets to use for attacks because they have this giant mechanism to go out and essentially do automated attacks on the sites, on the computers of would-be opponents or of people who are of interest to them to gain insight into what they're doing. So they've had this policy for some time that they actually purchase what they call 0 days, which are it's a bug that people have 0 days to fix before they can attack with it. That's why it's called a 0 days. But
so if I just met you at a party and you said Sean Gallagher, IT editor for Ars Technica, and I said, oh, let me ask you about that Heartbleed bug. What should I be concerned about as a consumer who uses the internet on my laptop?
Well, the first thing I'd be concerned about is whether the sites that I've used to log into for things like banking, my e-commerce accounts and things like that, if those servers had already been fixed. If they have been fixed, then it's time to change your password.
How do we know? How do we find out?
There are actually tools out there that you can use, and there's one linked in a story that I wrote that can tell you whether the site that you're going to is vulnerable to the bug. And if you type in the domain name for that site, it will go and it will check with a test to see if it gets a response that indicates that it's vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug.
That's the Dan Gooden story you're talking about?
Right.
That was on Ars Technica. Now there's an easy way to flag sites vulnerable to Heartbleed, so check out that story. We'll put a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Sean Gallagher with me, as I said. He is the Baltimore-based IT editor for Ars Technica with us this hour, this technology hour of midday. You're welcome to give us a ring, 410-662-8780. If you have a question about any of the stories that we cover in this hour with Sean Gallagher, we're going to tell you about a well-intentioned hacker when we get back who exposed flaws in the University of Maryland's IT system. Sean Gallagher with us for the hour. Again, 410-662-8780, the midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday, Midday Tech this hour. Dan Roderick with Sean Gallagher, IT editor for Ars Technica. And one last question from one of our listeners, Matt, who wants to know, was the Heartbleed bug hack an intentional hack?
No, not that we know of. I mean, the guy who did it says that it was equivalent of a very simple mistake he made while he was writing it. Now, the thing is this guy is a volunteer. All the people who contribute code to OpenSSL, it's an open source project, are volunteers. They're not paid much to do it. There's only a core group of people who are actually paid by the foundation that runs OpenSSL. There's only about six people involved in the core group. And so this is the software that protects 60-70% of the internet's communications. And it's run by an open source group that doesn't get a lot of money from the companies that use the software. It's one of those things that's strange. One of those things about open source is that, you know, some communities are like the Linux community, for example. A lot of money gets put into the Linux community through the Linux Foundation and people contributing code. But OpenSSL and other projects like that are really low key. People don't think that much about them.
Right.
But they're very important to the infrastructure of the internet, and very small number of people actually contribute to them on a regular basis. And the code is open. The code is there for people to review, and all these companies use it, and none of them have done the reviews that would have found the bug before now.
Were they just lucky?
They were very lucky.
It sounds like a system that depends very much on the integrity and the trustworthiness of volunteers.
Yes. But at the same time, all the code is open for everyone to review, which generally results in good
right.
code, generally results in high integrity code. But in this case, it was simply the way that memory was allocated in a specific piece of the program that made it vulnerable.
Sean, I wish you'd talk about this next story a little bit. Also from Ars Technica, a story you had a couple of weeks ago. White hat hacker goes too far, gets raided by FBI, tells all.
Right.
A white hat hacker from the Baltimore suburbs. What's this story?
So David Helkowski was an employee of the Canton Group here in Maryland, in Baltimore.
Software company?
It's a consulting company.
Okay.
They were working on a project for the University of Maryland on their website for the School of Public Health. And he alleges that in November of last year, he found a virus, well, he called it's a vulnerability, in the website for the School of Public Health, and he told his boss about it. And that was prior to the hack of the University of Maryland that exposed 300,000.
That we talked about, the last time you were here.
Right. Yeah. So the result of that was that vulnerability. Now, we don't know if that was the vulnerability that was used to do that hack, but the way that vulnerability got there was certainly used to, which was that the various websites at the University of Maryland had web pages that allowed people to upload graphics to them, upload pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, because of the way they were configured, you could upload any file through those pages, including a script that would run on the web server and allow people to gain access to the back end of the server. And he found some of these scripts on the server, told his boss about it, and figured it was going to get taken care of, and went away. And then after the exposure of the 300,000 Social Security numbers and birth dates back in February, he said, no, that couldn't have been the bug that I found, could it? And he went back and he checked, and it was still there, hadn't been touched. So he wrote a report up, he says. He went back to his boss and went with a colleague who was in charge of the Drupal project they were doing for the University of Maryland. They were moving things over from an old software platform called Cold Fusion to an open source system called Drupal, which is a publishing software package for doing websites. And he said, look, this is here. There's this vulnerability. This is bad news.
It's been here for a while.
It's been here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the company then told the University of Maryland, but he says that his bosses did not include him in the conversation and didn't use his report because they felt it was going to be embarrassing to them. That's what he alleges at this point. And I haven't heard back from the Canton Group yet. I called their CEO on Friday, and I haven't gotten a response back from them.
So what did he do that forced the company's hand and actually ended up in his being fired?
This is where he went a little bit too far.
Okay.
Right? So he decided after a conversation, he'd been pulled into a conference call with them, with the University of Maryland security people, and he gave them the list of things, and they had a report that he says that he leaked to them through a colleague who was a student at the University of Maryland. And then he decided things weren't changing quickly enough. 2 weeks later, he saw that there were some passwords to databases that hadn't been changed and things like that he could see. So he decided from home to hack into the University of Maryland system and show them that these vulnerabilities still existed and that there were all these problems. But he documented what he did, but he actually went in and he got got President Lowe, the president of the University of Maryland System's Social Security number and cell phone number, and posted them, and then sent an email to...
Posted them where?
On Reddit.
Oh, dear.
And then posted or sent an email to the members of
this. I mean,
this,
he kind of made his point, right?
Yeah.
You had me at got inside,
yeah,
right?
Yes.
You didn't need to.
It's not, and he didn't just get inside. He got inside. He actually set up a remote session to the server using the capabilities of the web server's access,
mm-hmm.
which was basically everything. And he compiled some programs. He set up a network scanner. He scanned mapped the entire internal network of the University of Maryland. He got into their Oracle database. He found a database that had a mirror of their directory service in it that had people's passwords in it, had people's social security numbers.
Did he need
their ID
all
numbers.
That? To, Sean, what do you think? Did he need to do all that to make his point?
He felt he did because he felt that nobody was responding to him. I don't know. This is something I'm still trying to find out from the University of Maryland system and from the Canton Group as far as what information was shared when. The thing is that they were in the middle of trying to repair issues as a result of the February break-in.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt he was communicating with a group of people through his project that were separate from the security task force that was set up at the University of Maryland, and that they were trying to cover their butts and make sure that they didn't get in trouble, and they didn't want to push these things up the chain and get in trouble and lose their jobs. So
the FBI came to his house?
So the FBI came to his house, and he was out with his wife, and his wife is a concert pianist, and they were at a performance that she was doing a small performance, and they came home, and the FBI had knocked in their back door and was searching their house, and the dog had gotten loose, and he came in with his wife, and they were held. You know, first of all, he was stopped at gunpoint on the street by a federal officer, and asked to get out of his car. And they were held in the house, and his dog was running around loose, and he asked the FBI if he could call his father to get the dog. And the FBI agent called his father, posing as a friend, saying that he saw the dog was loose. And his father arrived, the dog jumped in the car, and then the FBI agents detained his father while the search was going on. And his father gave him the riot act.
Was he charged with anything?
He hasn't been charged with anything yet. And
Is it still possible that he will be?
It's still possible, but he's cooperating. So he's given the FBI everything that he had. He explained what he was doing. But at the same time, he says he was laid off by his company. It may be fired for cause now.
Yeah.
I should also say that when I had an interview with him, and I had lunch with him about a week ago, the first thing he did is he handed me the cease and desist letter from the lawyers from the Canton Group. And said, you know, because they were concerned that he was going to mess up their contract
with the University of Maryland.
And attached to it was a copy of a non-disclosure agreement he had signed on March 6th, which was after all of this had happened. And he said, well, this doesn't affect anything I did before that, and it doesn't affect anything I did at home, so I'm going to tell you everything anyway.
So he told you the whole story.
He told me the whole story.
Yeah, and the last contact you had with him, you don't know what's happened.
I haven't heard anything more from him.
Yeah. Can I ask some? I mean, I know you report on these things, not always wanting to give your opinion about this, but I guess I sort of asked you already. Did he go too far?
I think to prove his point. I think he went too far when he posted information onto a public website.
Yeah,
that's going a little bit too far, especially with somebody's personal information, especially somebody's high profile as President Lowe. He feels like, you know, what he did, he would do it again if he was in the same situation, but he would never do something like this again anywhere else.
You need some water?
Sure.
There's a pitcher of water right over there, Jeff. Sean. Jeff was there our previous hour. Sean Gallagher is our guest. He's the IT editor for Ars Technica. He's based here in Baltimore and joins us from time to time on Midday to answer questions and get us up to date on tech news. 410-662-8780 is our number. Let's take a call from Sally in Baltimore County, who's calling about a previous story we discussed, the Heartbleed bug. Hi, Sally.
Hello. I know you were talking about the Heartbleed, and you said that with OpenSSL there is like a constant re-inquiry as to the security of the connection. And I noticed a couple months ago, starting off and on, when I signed into my Yahoo mail account, and I think maybe with other email accounts, I noticed that the text in the status bar would be disappearing and then reappearing again at about 1 second intervals, 1 second beats. And
so you have a question, Sally?
So I was wondering if as he said, there it's constantly, you know, reconfirming the secure connection. Is it could that flashing status bar at 1 second intervals possibly have anything to do with that? And then I think like the whole page started flashing once.
Okay, I'm not sure that that has anything to do with Heartblade. Was the lock that appears in the browser bar that shows that you have a secure connection, was that there?
Well, it was when I signed in.
Okay. So in the last week or so, Yahoo has fixed. Once the problem was resolved, was revealed,
mm-hmm.
Yahoo fixed it fairly quickly. And Yahoo has been in the process of moving everything over to being SSL ever since the issues with the NSA.
Did Yahoo seem to be more affected than others?
I don't think
Google,
Gmail?
Or?
I think, well, Google uses a different library internally. I'm not sure to what degree Yahoo and all of this were affected more than anyone else, but I do know that there was a very large number of sites that includes Yahoo that were using OpenSSL as part of their encryption.
Sean, I want to move on to another story, also NSA-related. Of course, NSA leaker Edward Snowden was back in the news following an appearance he made, I think this was just last week, during a live television show with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Basically, he appeared on the show to ask Putin a question about Russian surveillance. So
right.
we're gonna listen to this clip, first of all, and then we'll talk about it.
Now, I've seen little public discussion of Russia's own involvement in the policies of mass surveillance. So I'd like to ask you, does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals?
You have to get a court permission to stalk a particular person. We don't have a mass system of such interception. And according to our law, with our law, it cannot exist.
Now, Snowden was almost instantly criticized for throwing a softball question at Putin. I didn't quite get that, but I mean, he's not a seasoned
right.
journalist, right? He's not old Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes. He basically viewed this as an opportunity to criticize Putin, I think,
right,
and
right.
then he gets accused of throwing him a softball. It was too open-ended a question, maybe. Or
well, perhaps. I think that the question that he asked was fairly direct. He asked, is there surveillance that you do at a mass level? And I think that the answer he got back was not necessarily genuine. So,
right. What does he expect Putin to say? What would anyone expect Putin to say to a question like that?
You never know. I think that he was trying to show that he was openly questioning the country he's in, Snowden.
Right.
Was openly questioning the country he's in about surveillance in the same way that he questioned the United States surveillance. And I understand why he did that. The context within which he did it and the way that the question was answered made it look like he was being set up as somebody to give Vladimir Putin a softball to hit out of the park and beat on Obama with.
Right.
And I think that's why people were criticizing it, is because they saw this as Vladimir Putin saying, see, we are not as bad as the United States. We don't
right,
do it.
Right.
But the fact
timing,
is,
the timing of
the
it
timing,
with the Ukraine and
yeah,
everything,
the,
right?
The timing is horrible.
Yeah.
And the other pieces of this is that it's well known that while Russia may not have the equivalent of the NSA and have this giant retention capability, because nobody's got the same level of retention capability as the National Security Agency, the Russian federal security agencies have far fewer restrictions on how they do surveillance than agencies in the United States. And it's well known that there is a great deal of surveillance of Russian citizens without any sort of court interference. They can do surveillance for just about any reason.
What do you make of Snowden and his presence in in Russia. I mean, we know the practical reason why he's there, but in doing something like this, allowing himself to be treated as a celebrity in asylum, providing an opportunity to criticize the United States. What do you make of him? Because we don't have the opportunity to interview Snowden
right.
and know what motivates him these days.
Well, we're hoping we will. I think we've sent some questions at ours. We've sent some
Ars Technica.
Questions to his lawyer. We're hoping to have the chance someday to interview him. I think that he's trying to make the best out of a really, really bad situation, to be honest with you. He did not want to end up in Russia. That was not where he intended to be. He's sort of stranded there. And they were the country that gave him temporary asylum. He still only has a year's asylum there. And then Vladimir Putin gets to decide again whether he gets to hang around again.
Can you imagine the Obama administration, the Eric Holder Justice Department going easy on Snowden, changing their tact here?
No, I don't. And the reason is because if you look at the scope of what he's did compared to what Bradley Manning did, or Chelsea Manning, they're on a similar scale. And I think that there would be too much political pressure for them to be to allow them to be gentle on him. I know there has been some discussion of giving him amnesty, but it has been quickly brushed aside by people within the administration. So I don't think there's any chance they're going to go easy on him.
Sean Gallagher, our guest in this hour of Midday Tech, we call this hour. Sean is the IT editor for Condé Nast's Ars Technica website. When we get back, we want to talk about this other New York Times story recently. Interesting story and a troubling story. Technology's man problem that chronicles the alpha male sensibility within the technology and engineering fields. Sean will be right back and talk about that. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Sean Gallagher, Baltimore-based editor with Ars Technica website. Excellent website. Really rich, lots of good stories in there, and they keep up on tech news for the tech savvy, certainly Ars Technica. So I want to ask you about a story that appeared in the New York Times, actually, a couple weeks ago, man problem. And you had a chance to read it. I read it. It's a lengthy piece about women who are in the tech field, software development field, computer programmers, just having a hard time putting up maybe with the boys will be boys culture for a while and then realizing that they're really not welcome there, quitting the career altogether, some of them, quitting companies, moving on, complaining of sexism, rampant sexism. Some pretty disturbing stories, anecdotes related in this story in the New York Times.
And it's not uncommon. I mean, we've encountered this sort of thing all the time. Even at ours, we've had some issues with readership reacting to the women who are writers for us and objectifying some of the folks who write for us.
Really?
So it's a cultural thing it has to do with a lack of social skills with some of them. Mm-hmm. With others it's just because they come from a sort of community of people who are trying to exert machismo exude machismo on others, and so they be he-men within a group of people who are not necessarily concerned to be he-men at any time. Mm-hmm. Now, let's think about, I don't mean to be stereotypical because I'm kind of a geek myself, right? But there's a lot of, it's not exactly what we call an open community to women. And this is a conversation that I had with Mario Armstrong and some other folks when we did a panel for Baltimore Tech Week. It's endemic across science, technology, and math.
Yeah, we dealt with that here on Midday,
engineering,
STEM fields in general.
So
right?
So there's not enough women in the field to begin with, and there's a culture, a bro culture, as it was referred to, that sort of repels women from it as well. And it's difficult for people to inject themselves, and for women to inject themselves into this community and feel welcome when there's already this huge culture of geek guys who think in terms of objectifying women from the culture they absorb from video games and things like that. So,
is there some threshold women aren't expected to cross in that field? In other words, some jobs that they're maybe would be more comfortable in are not subject to this sort of abuse or criticism or
well,
more
if you
welcoming
look at,
culture?
If you look at some of the big tech companies out there, there are a lot
like
of
Silicon
women,
Valley.
Yeah, there in Silicon Valley, there are a number of women who are CEOs, and they've all come into the business from different directions. There's Meg Whitman at HP. There's Marissa Meyer at Yahoo, who came from Google. And you know, both of them have talked to some degree about not, about the credibility of being a woman in those businesses, and you know it's been difficult for them. But you know, generally speaking, women have always been sort of the outsiders in those companies. If you look at the history of HP, Carly Fiorina when she came in as right. CEO, and the amount of heat she got when she was CEO, and largely it was because she was a woman entering a man's world. To be honest, I think that was a lot of it. There were other management issues, but really the biggest issue was she was a woman at the top of a company that was a very male-centric company.
You wonder what's going to break this or change it, because if the word out, the word is out that in the field, as a career, as a profession, you're not welcome. That's going to affect girls in high school. It's going to affect
right.
young women in college
right.
and their course choices, their career choices.
Well, I think that it's going to require a sea change within the industry. I think it's going to require people to take a different attitude about how they do things. I think it also is going to require sort of return of human resources to how, because a lot of these small startups, they don't really take into account a lot of the things that large companies have learned over time about
right.
dealing with diversity.
They have a different
like
focus.
That. Yeah, and the thing is that have you seen the new HBO series Silicon Valley?
No.
Oh, you've got to see the new series Silicon Valley, the Mike Judge series, which is a comedy about Silicon Valley. It's dead on these things.
Oh, I got to see that.
And so there was the article in the Times talked about how the woman realized she was in the wrong place when the guy was talking about a new app that was men staring at breasts.
Yeah, it was
right?
photos of yourself staring at breasts.
Right. So it was selfies of you staring at breasts, right?
Yeah.
The show Silicon Valley, an app that one of the guys wrote in the show was called Nip Alert or something like that.
Oh,
and
so
when somebody sees breasts, it gives an alert that they've seen breasts.
Mm.
And the thing is that that's the kind of application you'd think, you know, if you think of, you know, emotionally underdeveloped teenage
yeah,
type 13-year-old guys, 13-year-old boys,
yeah.
right? That's sort of the culture of that.
Yeah,
group.
It goes back to the point you're making
right.
about social development.
And I don't mean to be
frozen as a 13-year-old.
I don't mean to throw a blanket over it, because honestly, there are a lot of people who are really smart and who are also very, well, you know, very socially skilled within the community. But there's a lot of prolonged childhood going on in the tech industry because of the way people work in a community. It's like it's like working in a frat house. A lot of companies, you know, there are no walls. There's, you know, the way we've promoted the tech industry. I remember the first tech company I worked at, you know, everybody had a cubicle with an Etch-a-Sketch with their name on the door, and everybody had Nerf guns and was shooting at each other at the
right.
top. There's
right.
a foosball table in the middle of the office.
Right.
You know, and so the way that you attracted people to these companies, these smart people, these companies, was to make it more like playing games all the time, right?
Like a big playroom.
Right, and so as a result of that, people have brought a whole different idea of what it is to be at work with them to these companies. And they think of it just as like when they were in college in their frat house or in whatever, you know, wherever they crashed with their friends and played video games all day long.
Sean Gallagher with us from Ars Technica. We'll move on to another story. We call this Facebook identity crisis. Facebook purchased the virtual reality company Oculus.
Right.
What brings us to this question of Facebook and an identity crisis? We're wondering why Facebook would buy a company like this.
I don't think there's any question why.
Okay.
So Mark Zuckerberg's using his ownership of Facebook, his percentage of his stock is Facebook, to basically turn Facebook into a venture capital company. Facebook itself has matured to the point now, the company is about 15 years old now.
10? I thought they had their decade
anniversary. Yeah, so they're about 10 years old. The company has matured to the point now where their product is in the process of trying to find new ways to deliver their product to people. Oculus is a totally different market, but Mark Zuckerberg realizes that this virtual reality stuff is a potential gold mine long term, not as something that's attached to Facebook, but as a technology in itself. He's also recently acquired a drone company, an unmanned aerial vehicle company that makes solar-powered drones. And that's for another project that that Facebook and other companies are involved in called Internet.org. They're looking to turn these things into what they call atmospheric satellites, where they park these unmanned vehicles over an area and provide internet access with it, wireless internet access, particularly in Africa where there's no infrastructure to deliver internet.
Right.
They're talking about having these solar-powered drones over all of Africa so people can
just stay up there forever.
They can stay up for five, six years.
Wow.
Because they use solar power.
Hmm.
It's a similar investment. Oculus is a technology that it does 3D virtual reality. It hasn't really been deployed yet as part of the gaming industry, but there are a lot of people who have the goggles out there right now.
So this is just
a growth
Zuckerberg
market.
Investing.
Yeah, it's just him investing.
Nothing more.
But
than
Facebook
that.
Is having an issue now in that.
Yeah, it's 10
in order
years
for them
old.
To in order right. for them to innovate, now they have to start thinking about new ways to deliver what they do. So they're actually starting to break up the pieces of what Facebook is and deliver it as different applications.
And it's not considered as cool as it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
I wouldn't say that to them.
Right.
I mean, I was at the Facebook campus a couple of weeks ago.
They still have a massive reach. I know that, but I mean, our young, you know,
no, they're doing some really interesting things, and they're doing something internally to try and become more innovative again. The problem is, once you get to be a company of that size, how do you keep making yourself reinvent new things? So they,
I don't know. Couldn't you see it as a utility?
Yes.
I mean, it's a utility.
It is
something
a utility.
That everybody's going to use at
right.
some point.
And that's right? and that's how they're approaching it. They've gone and they've set up this Ingenuity Lab where they have people basically, they're creating new applications that use Facebook as a back-end utility. And I think what you're going to see more and more of is Facebook used as identity. When you go to a website and ask if you want to log in with your Facebook ID, for example, you're going to be seeing more of that. And because of that, that gets integrated more and more into your life. And so they're going to find more and more ways to leverage that.
Sean, I've been dying to ask you about Amazon's next venture. There are reports that it's developing a smartphone. I guess these are confirmed by
right.
now.
So there's a company that's doing something totally off of what it... I mean,
right.
Amazon started as what? As
selling books online.
Selling as a book online, right?
Yeah.
And they've totally diverged from that.
Yeah.
I think a good deal of their profit now comes from their web services company, which they provide the servers in the cloud for hundreds of businesses.
Right.
And now they're becoming a consumer technology company, and they've done this Fire TV with those Gary Busey ads, with Gary Busey
yeah,
talking.
Yeah, I like those ads.
And
it's a great use of Gary Busey.
So, yes. And this phone, I mean, it's an extension of what they've been doing with Kindle. And what they're trying to do with this phone, apparently, based on the Wall Street Journal report I read, is it's going to use four cameras on the front of the phone to track your eyes so that it sees where you're looking at the phone and changes what's on the phone's screen to make it look 3D to you. So,
is this why it's referred to hologram, 3D hologram?
Well, it's not.
It's not really a hologram.
It's not really a hologram. It's using tricks of optics
to
make it look 3D to you. And this eye tracking technology has been around for a while. There's actually another company called Oculus Labs in Hunt Valley that has been doing security stuff with...
No connection to the Oculus.
No connection with Oculus Rift, no. And spelled with an I, not a U. They do this technology that puts cameras on your screen so that when you look away from your computer, it blurs your screen so nobody else can see it. But there's also a technology they use for the government that allows you to... It has two cameras, tracks your eyes, and it actually scrambles the rest of the screen so a passerby can't read your screen. Only you can read your screen based on where your eyes are focused on the screen.
Hmm.
And that's...
Is this a selling point? What do you think?
For a mass audience? For a phone, for doing 3D, it's...
You got to come up with something new.
You got to come up with something new, I guess.
Right?
I guess where they're looking to go with this is to do things in what they call augmented reality and in virtual reality gaming. They want to be able to do these handheld games where you can interact with the environment. One of the things they said is that if you move the phone towards your face, that it will zoom the text on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
for you and things like that. So it's the phone, I wouldn't necessarily say this is something you're going to use to like manage your address book on your phone, right?
Right.
But it's something that's going to be another avenue for interactivity with your phone to do different things. And so
it's clear you got to do something to stand out in the smartphone market.
Right. Right. And you know, given the fact that the smartphone market has become somewhat ossified in terms of who's got what market share at this point. You've got Samsung, you've got Apple, and then you've got Microsoft trying to edge it out BlackBerry, and BlackBerry sort of falling off the map.
Right.
In order to break into the business, you have to do something really revolutionary, and I think that's what Jeff Bezos is trying to do with this.
I remember it was about a year ago, Jeff Bezos was on 60 Minutes and mentioned using drones to deliver Amazon products to our driveways, our front doors, right through our windows.
Something we referred to as the biggest troll of the year last year.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I do not envision that happening anytime soon.
Well, Sean, I bring up drones because you had an interesting story just the other day posted at ArsTechnica.com. High in the sky, drones spot pot farms so criminals can rob them.
Yes, yes, the Omar drones.
Omar, reference to The Wire
in
Baltimore.
So apparently, this is based on an interview from an English newspaper. There are criminals who are using drones equipped with infrared cameras to fly over these rural neighborhoods in outside of I forget which city it was, but
was it Birmingham?
Birmingham, yes, outside of Birmingham. Yeah. So in the rural districts outside of Birmingham, England, to look for the heat that comes off of the grow lights from these rapidly growing number of pot farms in rural areas where people are growing marijuana for sale. And what they're doing is they're using these infrared cameras to spot them by the drones. So they can go in and then rob the pot growers or extort money out of them or extort marijuana out of them for resale by the criminals.
That's what Omar did in The Wire.
Well, he robbed dealers.
He robbed drug dealers.
Yeah, he robbed
drug
dealers. Right.
Right. So, is the police doing anything about this?
I don't know. I'm assuming that they are now that the story is out there. But the thing is that this is sort of similar to what happens with law enforcement in the United States. They use the same technology. Not too long ago, there was the New York State National Guard collaborated with New York State Police, and they were using helicopters equipped with infrared gear to spot marijuana farms in the Adirondacks and in other parts of upstate New York. So it's a similar approach, only this is using a drone, and the drone costs one of these drones, which you can set up to fly by GPS coordinates. They cost like $700.
Yeah. Let me just quote this fellow because this is amusing. One of the fellows who's involved in this scheme told his local newspaper, "It's not like I'm using my drone to see if they have nice televisions. I am just after drugs to steal and sell. If you break the law, then you enter me in my drone's world."
Right.
Half the time, we don't even need violence to get the crop.
Right. But what about the other half?
That's right.
What about the other half? That's the other question.
You can find Sean Gallagher's stories and the stories of all the staff of Ars Technica, all their contributors at ArsTechnica.com, keeping up on the latest tech news. Sean joins us here on Midday from time to time for that same purpose. Nice to have you with us again, Sean. Thank you for filling us in on all these issues. Sean will be back again. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our Midday for today. Our director, Matt Tackett, today. Thank you, Matt, and thank you, everybody. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.